our chance for crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven the middle of it. Grass makes heaven the middle. We are grass makes heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We have one of the finest guests this evening. Out of Dallas, he's a professor at SMU. Name is Ravi Batra. He's the author of End Unemployment Now. Welcome to our program, Ravi Batra.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I tell you what, I've followed you since late 80s, 1980-something, when you came out with that first book that I read. And I can only say that you've really laid it out there. Tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and what motivated you to write this book.
Well, a long time ago, I had a very great teacher in India, and he asked me, what's your goal in life? And I said, well, I am an economist, and I want to use my knowledge to end poverty in India. And he said, this is a good goal, but this is not enough. Your goal should be to end poverty in the world. That's what he said to me.
Okay.
That's a tall order. And so then I studied his theories of economics, and I came to the conclusion that whenever there is tremendous inequality in society, income and wealth inequality in society, the end result is a big rise in poverty and a drop in the living standard. So I decided that I would focus on these ideas, and in fact, I found out the logical reason why rising concentration of wealth creates so much poverty, and I wrote a lot of books starting with the 1980s about it, and you can see ever since the early 80s, poverty has been rising in the United States. In fact, now it's the worst in the last over 50 years. The poverty in America is now the worst in over 50 years. In the meanwhile, the rich have gotten richer than never before. And so the question is, what should be done? And that's why I wrote my latest book on it, because in previous books, I had talked about what causes unemployment and poverty and offered certain reforms, which I realize now that cannot be fulfilled, cannot materialize because of the political situation, because of Congress and the fact that the rich control the politicians. So finally, I decided to write a book which just appeared. It's called End Unemployment Now. But then there is a subtitle, How to Eliminate Joblessness, Debt, and Poverty Despite Congress. So that politicians are not even relevant in this situation, in the reforms that are offered now. In fact, I've shown that you can end poverty in America within 6 months. It is so easy to fix end poverty in the United States without going through Congress that people don't even realize it. In fact, the reviews I received from some top magazines said that, call President Obama, call your Congress people, and tell them all these solutions, easy solutions are available to end poverty right now. And that's what I've done just about, the book came out about 2 months ago.
Right. You met with Nancy Pelosi and Bernanke at one time before you began writing this book. Tell us about that.
Well, I met Nancy Pelosi in Dallas. She was here in 2010, and I talked about these solutions. At that time, the president's election, president was very unpopular, and I thought that if I offered him good solutions, good ideas, they would adopt them, and the poverty. But and Nancy Pelosi was very thrilled. She was thrilled by these ideas, and she was amazed how simple it was to fix the economy. And then she called Ben Bernanke, but Ben Bernanke was interested only in printing more money, and so he did not pay attention even to the simplest of reforms that I offered, how you could bring the credit card interest, the interest on credit card loans, for which the banks charge something like 20 to 30%, that interest can be brought down to just 5% through an action of the president. And if the president were to do that, he would go in history as another FDR. But there is politics still a lot of politics there. So Nancy Pelosi could not go through with this. She lost she was at that time, I think, the majority leader in the House, and she or the speaker in the House, and she's no longer the speaker, so nothing came after that.
Right. Since 2007, you think that we've been in a recession, and we've never really come out of that. What would your thoughts be on from between 2007 and 2015? Have we progressed? Is our economy growing? Is it becoming robust again? Where are we right now?
Well, the economy is growing, but the poor and the middle class, their living standard is getting worse. So what is the value of this growth if people's living standard falls or poverty becomes the worst in more than 50 years? So there is something, the economy is growing because of the huge budget deficit and the excessive printing of money, but it's not helping the people. Right now, we are about the same, at about the same level of jobs we had in 2007. The number of jobs right now is the same as we had in 2007. And in the meanwhile, population has grown a lot. So I don't understand why they call that the recession has ended, when in terms of the living standards and people's wages and salaries, things are even worse than before.
Right. You seem to write about maldistribution of wealth and monopolistic capitalism. Expand your thoughts to our listening audience a little bit on those two ideas.
Well, that's the whole cause of our problems. We have a monopoly capitalism right now. We don't have a free market system. In monopoly capitalism, giant firms control the markets. They don't have pure monopoly, but they have a huge power to raise prices. So they charge high prices, pay very low wages, and at the same time, they make their employees work very hard. Now, the result is productivity keeps rising. When employees work very hard, they are highly educated now, and technology has improved sharply. So productivity is rising and wages don't. So the result is supply rises. As productivity goes up, supply goes up. But wages rise, demand doesn't rise. So when supply exceeds demand, there is overproduction. Overproduction causes layoffs and poverty. And then these politicians, they hate unemployment also, because if people are laid off, some incumbent politicians are also laid off because the unemployed have votes. They vote at the time of election, and they throw incumbents out of power. So the politicians then turn around. They create artificial spending through government debt and by bringing interest rates down, so people borrow more money and spend out of their borrowing. They can't spend much from their wages because wages are not rising. So they want people to spend money out of borrowing. The result is consumers are in huge debt. The government is in huge debt. Students are in debt. The only one who is benefiting from this entire system are those monopoly capitalists who keep buying small companies and keep growing at the same time, and so the rich are getting richer like never before, and the poor and the middle class are where they were in 2000. There's not much improvement for them. Even with the start and after the recession.
Right. You see the Davos meeting there in Switzerland every year in January, and the largest corporations, some 2,500 or more, meet there, and you really see that corporation power and that exactly what you're talking about is that the corporations have become so large that they're creating a monopolistic market, aren't they?
That's right. They have monopoly power, and so what I'm suggesting is that the president can use the laws where he, through those laws, can create competition for these large companies. The Congress would not break them up. Congress is bought out by these giant firms themselves. So Congress would not break them up. But if we were to create competition through some laws which already exist, then these giant firms will have to reduce their prices. They will have to offer higher wages, and poverty will disappear. As I've shown, through sanctions, poverty can disappear in just overnight, just within 2 weeks. And for us, through some other actions, it may take about 6 months to get rid of poverty altogether. And unemployment would also disappear very quickly. Even those who are long-term unemployed, who have been so discouraged by the job market that they have stopped looking, and there are about 9 million of them, they will also find jobs, and then our economy would be on a very sound footing. We would create jobs and end poverty while reducing the debt at the same time, and that's, I think, the best type of economy that you can think
right.
of.
How much of our economy now, the employment, is industrial jobs? Is it 8%, something like that? Or most of our industrial jobs have gone overseas. Is that right?
Well, that's right. 8% of our labor force is in manufacturing now. And compare this to what we had in 1800. In 1800, 5% of our labor force was in manufacturing. So how far are we from what the economy was in 1800, more than 200 years ago? So we are in a horrible situation, and this is what monopoly capitalism does to any economy. It's not just the United States. You have monopoly capitalism in Europe, in China, everywhere. It's the same thing. Everywhere the rich are getting richer, and there is overproduction. And because of overproduction, Now you see that there has been a huge stock market crash in China. This is going to hurt the whole world again within just the next 3 to 4 months. So whatever little progress we have seen over the last 7-8 years is going to go away very soon, because China has crashed, and U.S. manufacturing is down to just 8% of the labor force working in manufacturing India. So it's really not very encouraging when you look into the near
right. When we went into this quantitative easing, was that the beginning of the end for the country, so to speak, or what? I mean, and then we took interest rates down to almost zero. Doesn't that foretell of a collapse of some kind imminent?
Oh yes. Quantitative easing has stabilized things for the very rich. They have become very rich because of this quantitative easing. There were lots of bailouts of big banks and other giant companies like General Motors, Chrysler, and so on. There were lots of bailouts for them. So they have regained their footing, and they created some jobs, but the cost of this job creation is huge. You can see that we have added $8 trillion in debt. $8 trillion more in debt, in federal debt, since after Obama came to power. And from those $8 trillion, we have created about 8 million jobs. Not created, but we are back to where we were. We had lost 8 million, so we are back to where we were. So the cost of that job creation is about $1 million per person. When when the average wage is less than $50,000 a year. With spending $1 million to create, to go back to where we were in terms of job creation, and the job pays only less than $50,000.
Oh my gosh, boy, that's, you talk about bad economics. what better example than you could give right there, right?
This is horrible. Because, so the question is, where did all this extra money go? Of course, it went to the very rich. It has to go to the so-called job creators. They're not job creators. They're really job destroyers because they're extracting so much money, so much wealth from the poor and the
middle. When this money in the form of surpluses, say, inside the banks, begins to be loaned into the economy, could it set off a wave of inflation that could be disastrous?
No, inflation is not going to be a problem because we get so much from China. The prices of Chinese goods are so low that we are not going to get much inflation because of excessive printing of money. There will be some inflation, but not too much. But what's happening is that the cost of production for the companies for goods that they import from China is very small, but they charge very high prices here, so their profits keep rising. In fact, under President Obama, the rate of profit is at the all-time high in history. And this information comes from New York Times and also the economic report of the president. The economic report of the president itself shows that the rate of profit is now at its all-time in history. And when President Obama keeps, and other liberals keep saying that, they keep talking about how high profits are, and the fact is they themselves, the excessive money creation and excessive debt in the economy is a source of these high profits. Because as I said, if you have spent $8 trillion to preserve, not create, to preserve 8 million jobs, the cost of each job preserved is $1 million when the job itself pays less than $50,000 on average. So the rest, the surplus is going all to the rich.
Oh, I tell you. What? It's getting crazy, isn't it, huh? are we in a deflationary cycle right now? Is that what's happening?
Well, as far as the people's living standard is concerned, yes, we are in a depressionary cycle. In fact, there was a study by a big company, their website is bankrate.com. Their study was that more than 60% of Americans have about $500 in their checking or savings account. More than 60% of Americans, let me repeat, have just $500 in their savings or checking account. So if there is any emergency, they have to go into loan big time. If their car breaks down or if they have a health emergency, what is this $500? What is it going to do? If somebody is laid off, they have to go on welfare right away. So it's a horrible situation. And that's a study by a big company, bankrate.com, is their website. And then there is another study by the ex-former president's daughter, Laura Bush. She found, to her credit, it's a great credit to her, she found that about 50 million Americans, 50 million of them, go partially hungry every day. She talked about hunger.
My gosh.
50 million of them. And remember, we don't have 50 million unemployed people. We have 10 to 15 million. That means lot of employed people go partially hungry in America every day. This is how bad the situation is. And politicians are not paying any attention. And that's why I decided to write this new book with a challenging title, that despite Congress, we can fix the economy easily if somebody were to take an initiative and adopt laws and adopt reforms that will provide competition, that will create free enterprise for these giant firms. Because you can create free enterprise by creating, the government can also create competition. In fact, there are laws that exist on the books which say that it's the duty of the government to create competition in the markets. It's the duty of the government to enforce anti-monopoly laws. But these laws have not been enforced ever since 1981. And even now, there are a lot of mergers. Recently, there was a merger between American Airlines and U.S. Airways. And you want to know why, what for? All they have done is eliminate some flights, increase prices for the consumers, and they are merging. Even the oil prices are now way down, and they are going to make a lot of money anyway, but still the government permitted them to have a merger. What for? So this merger reduces competition. They are not enforcing anti-monopoly laws. So all I'm saying is, create free enterprise in the system. Don't print more money. Don't create more debt. That free enterprise itself will take away the power of monopoly capitalists and increase demand for workers, increase wages and demand for workers, bring prices down, and poverty will disappear very quickly.
Boy, I tell you what, those are some good suggestions. The trade balance out there, it's really way out of proportion, is it not?
It's the trade balance. So, you know, we have, okay, the economists like free trade, although free trade has not done much good to America. But I say, okay, if you have to have free trade because we have so many treaties with the rest of the world, but then at least have balanced free trade. You import as much as you export. But because this trade deficit kills manufacturing, and as manufacturing disappears, wages fall. So service wages are not very high. Manufacturing wages are higher, but so at least take care of the trade deficit. If we were to eliminate the trade deficit, keep free trade, but just eliminate the trade deficit, we would create 5 million jobs, 5 million manufacturing jobs in 1 year. Because the factories are already there. Factories already exist, but because of the trade deficit, they stand idle. They have laid off people. Once we eliminate the trade deficit, our companies will have a lot of new business. These factories which have been shut down, they will open up. Factories are already there. They will hire people. And 5 million new jobs can be created right away in manufacturing. That will raise wages and also eliminate
right.
poverty.
How do derivatives factor into this whole overall economic dilemma that we're facing right now? How does that work into the economy and so forth?
Well, see, a lot of money has been printed, and it has gone to the banks. And the people are not borrowing that much because their collateral is gone. They had home equities. They used to borrow money on their homes, but home equity is now gone. So there's not much collateral with people, and so there's not much lending by the banks. So what do they do with this extra money? They use this extra money to speculate in oil and to speculate in the derivatives. And they are actually the net sellers of these derivatives. They create markets in these options and futures, and they sell them to the investors. And by selling them, since they are selling it, they make a lot of money. So you see, bank profits are also very high. And their profits show up in the extremely high salaries of their CEO. So the whole idea is the entire system is now running to make the rich richer, and it doesn't care about the poverty level for the rest of the people. And unfortunately, this poverty would keep rising because the rich productivity continues to rise. That creates extra supply. There's not much demand for goods and services, so wages won't rise, and the rich will keep getting richer, and they will speculate even more. And this way, the prices of stocks and bonds, stocks will keep rising, and bonds will keep rising. But that will only help the people who lend money to us, that is, who are very rich, and they get richer through these to the asset, to the purchase of these assets, the stocks and bonds and oil and gold and so on.
When the Glass-Steagall Act was changed, and I think that was under Clinton, did that open up the possibilities where it sort of converted the banks into much more of a casino operation? What would you say about something like that?
Well, that's one thing I would bring the Glass-Steagall Act back. But again, you see, this would require an act of Congress. So even though it's desirable, I don't put much focus on that. All I say is there are laws on the system, laws on the books, which the president, whether it's a Republican or an independent or a Democrat, any president can use those laws to create competition for these giant firms. And when they face competition, prices will automatically go down. Let the president enforce anti-monopoly laws. And if he enforces those laws, prices will come down, wages will rise, there'll be more employment, and automatically things would start to improve. And enforcing these laws does not require increasing the budget deficit or excessive printing of money. So our economy would go back to the free enterprise system, and that's what we really need.
I guess examples of capitalism would work best in small enterprises. Would that not be an accurate statement? And then when we got to these large transnationals, it started becoming such a money power and influence over Congress, they started buying everybody. What would you say?
Yeah, capitalism works best when you have small companies, so small firms. As a simple example, there used to be so many gas stations.
Yes, every corner, almost every corner had one.
Every corner used to have two or three gas stations, and there was a lot of competition for gas.
Right.
And then those people who owned those small gas stations, they made good living. But now these oil companies have bought them out. They have eliminated all these gas stations. So gas is now more than $2 a barrel. It went up to almost $4-$5 per gallon. And the oil companies made huge profits. And then they justified this was good for the consumer. That's what they said. So when you eliminate competition by not enforcing antitrust laws or anti-monopoly laws, the end result is that the people suffer.
Well, now, these super PACs, they just played into the worst dynamics, haven't they not? It's just becoming unreal, the cost of these elections. Do you see Trump or someone like that coming in that's trying to make some, suggestions that might do any good or not?
Well, as I said, the reforms that I've offered in this new book, anybody can implement them, whether it's a Democrat, Republican, or independent. So whether it's Trump or Hillary or Bernie Sanders, doesn't matter. The reforms would work because all we have to create is competition, and the public is looking for somebody who is not a politician or political type. Because the public has, in general, has about $500 in their checking and savings.
My gosh.
The
economy is fragile. It could just collapse at any time, couldn't it?
Yeah, the economy could.
Because nobody has any savings to see themselves through.
Yeah, well, they used up all their savings in the previous mega recession. After 2007, most people used up their savings. And now they have some jobs, but these jobs don't pay enough. In fact, as I said earlier, a study by Laura Bush, daughter of ex-President George W. Bush, she has offered a study in which about 50 million people go partially hungry every day. Hungry. In this country, which is supposed to be the richest in the world.
You think the American public has been driven by hedonistic and materialistically driven motives and stuff like that? That's overweighed some of their thoughts and actions?
I think the public doesn't really care as long as
things. They don't have a clue, do they? You think?
Exactly. There's so much propaganda. The media is controlled by the minority capitalists. So the public really doesn't understand, and that's why the book I've written is so simple to understand. It has it's based on totally on common sense, and the common sense is this: if supply is greater than demand, then there is overproduction, and overproduction causes layoffs and poverty. And what causes supply to exceed demand? Rising productivity and stagnant wages. And that's what has been happening in the United States for the past 30 to 35 years. And so this is common sense. Create free markets, and that will raise wages to the level of productivity. And since productivity is very high, wages will also rise sharply. Poverty will disappear very quickly. You do not need any government debt. You don't need any consumer debt. People will be able to afford the necessities of life out of their wages rather than go into debt.
It's almost as if Disneyland or Disney World has been taken from those theme parks and transplanted into the U.S., you know, public at large almost. People are into fantasy. I'll tell you an example that I could give on this. I was parked in a parking lot one night. I was just leaving a restaurant that closed pretty late, and I looked over at this game retail outlet, and about an hour before 11 or whatever, all these people, 100 cars showed up, and they were there to buy a game, the newest, latest game, you know what I mean, that was sweeping the nation. And they spent almost $1 billion on that game. I think it was $700 million that night on that game. Is that what America has become?
Well, that's the effect of all this.
Yeah, gamesters. We play games. We're in a fantasy world. We go and watch entertainment, sports, but we don't concentrate on the real essence of the problems.
Exactly.
I love that latest game. I played it all night one night. You know what I mean? Is that the mentality that has evolved here? Huh? I mean, people don't get it, and they're not going to get it until there's a major problem. Then they might start paying attention, huh?
Yeah, right, exactly.
And, you know, all of your life, you've spent a lot of time writing all of these books, trying to warn people. And this latest book is a very good book. I was looking over the index too, because after I've read parts of the book, and I like to look at that index, and that index, you're covering BRICS, you're covering just so many other, topics in this book. And how about the European Central Bank? Are they not doing quantitative easing, but in a little bit different way right now?
They are doing exactly the same thing what the U.S. did. And they are in no good position either, because they also have monopoly capitalism. Their monopoly capitalism is not as severe as ours. I mean, their profits are not so high, but the profits of our companies are at their all-time high. But they have the same problem that we have, and their unemployment rate is around 11%. And that's the official unemployment rate is around 11%. The unofficial is perhaps 15 to 16%. So, and then there is China. China has had a stock market crash after June, and the market crash, and so they are going to be in big problem themselves. So I think whatever little progress we have seen in the past 5, 6, 7 years, it's going to disappear by the end of the year.
How about BRICS? Is that going to give the Western financial institutions a run for their money, some competition? What's going to happen there?
Brazil, even BRICS in Brazil, Russia, India, and China, right?
The South Africa is one of them too, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. So that makes it BRICS, right. So it's 5 countries. Yeah, South Africa is already in recession. Russia is in mega recession. India is doing fine, but China's stock market has crashed. Brazil is in bad situation. So there is very little optimism around the world, and that's exactly why you saw the Dow Jones Index one day crashed for about 600 points. The Dow is below what it was at the start of the year. So are many other stocks. So you can't see any light. You can't see the light anywhere in the world. At least not a firm light. So that's why I think that by the end of the year, the economy would look in a dire shape. And that means a Republican is more likely to win the presidency than a Democrat.
Right. You said something interesting about Trump. He's not, a politician. He's a businessman, and he does say some things that's probably on people's mind, like this immigration problem. See, but is he gonna not go in there and then succumb to the same powers, an interest, a money interest? That I mean, he's into money too. See, right?
Well, in his case, the things are different. That he doesn't need money from
the right. That's a good point. Yeah.
He has his own money, so he won't be beholden to
right.
to them, and so he could be the next president of the United States. And Republicans generally like free enterprise, so they might adopt my reforms that I've offered. The liberal Democrats are more into government spending and tax increases, but a Republican is more likely to accept these reforms because in the end, we have to improve the lot of the people. We have to improve the living standard of the country. And if a president does that, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, he or she would go down in history as one of the greatest presidents in the United States.
Right. Greenspan received in 2002 an honorary knighthood for the Queen of England. Did you know that?
Right.
And that was in 2002. Then he finished up his Federal Reserve position there, chairman, in 2004. Is that money power in the City of London? That's very great, isn't it?
Well, certainly. Well, let me say something about
Greenspan.
Sure,
go ahead.
He actually was chairman until 2006.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Okay.
And he was the architect of this borrow and spend
right.
economics. And so I went through his record, and I wrote a book called Greenspan Fraud while he was still in it. And in that book, I wrote that he is going to create a tremendous recession through his policies, and it won't take long. And I put a date in the book that around 2007, a huge recession would start, and then the economies in the world would remain stagnant until about 2016. That was my forecast in that book and and another book that I wrote soon after that. And really, everybody laughed at me. Greenspan fraud, he was knighted.
Robbie's lost it, you know, right? But people are critical, you know what I mean. You go out on the edge there and take a risk. That's what I like about you, Robbie, you know? You get out there and predict. I mean, some of your prediction didn't work out quite right, but others did.
Well, I have listed all my predictions now and listed those that didn't work and those that did work. It turns out that out of the 50 I've made, 3 turns out wrong.
Right.
So, I don't mind having that kind of record. In fact, there is an article in Fort Worth Weekly. It was published, I think, in 2008 or 9. That article noted this fact that I have been the best economic forecaster ever in history. So now I'm saying that until 2016, the world economy is going to stay in stagnation, but I think when the new president takes over, he or she will introduce the reforms that I'm offered, and we will come out of this poverty cycle.
Right. You have some of your writings on truth-out.org, so I had that up on our site tonight. And so our listening audience can go in there, and I encourage them to go in. Also, I have that YouTube that you did with Mazzoni, I think it is. We have that up there. And then we have
That's
a Huffington Post article also. We put up everything that's relevant to some of your writings and so forth. And some of your suggestions is to stop this bailout of the banks, right? Wasn't that catastrophic?
Yeah. Well, the bailout of the bank that created a huge jump in the price of oil to about $100 a barrel, even above that. And in fact, you will be surprised to know that when the first bailout was passed under George W. Bush, even before the bailout was passed, I wrote an article that this bailout would take the price of oil above $100 very quickly. At that time, oil was about $30 a barrel. This was in 2008. And I said this bailout would raise the price of oil sharply. And again, people are scratching their heads. Why in the world would this bailout increase the price of oil? And I said to them, look, this will bail out the banks. If the banks are bailed out, what would happen? The people are not borrowing money. The banks would have the money. They would use the money to speculate in oil. That's what they always do. When they have extra money, they use it for speculation when other people are not borrowing it. So they would use it to speculate in oil, create artificial demand for it, and just watch. Oil prices would go up to back to $100.
Right. You go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I predicted that the oil price would go back to $100 per barrel. Well, then I also said that eventually, because this will be violating the laws of supply and demand, eventually oil would crash after 2012. This is also in my book, There are various books, which you have mentioned, which you may have on the website, like Greenspan's Fraud or The New Golden Age. In these books, I have these various forecasts that oil would keep rising. These forecasts were made in 2005 and 2006. Oil would keep rising until about 2012 because of artificial demand through speculation. But eventually, the laws of supply and demand would take over, and oil would crash after 2012. And once it crashes, we have another huge problem in the economy, because this oil industry has a debt load of more than $1 trillion. And they are not going to, they won't be able to pay back their bondholders, and these bondholders may have to declare bankruptcy. And once that cycle starts, you watch out. I think this oil crash is going to have big problems in the near future.
Right. You're saying that. Repeat that about the debt again, please, sir.
See, the oil companies, like these fracking companies, the oil
shale companies. Oh, okay.
Which started after the oil price jumped to near $100 a barrel. Many companies started, and then they borrowed a lot of money and offered very high
interest. Oh, I see.
These are called junk bonds. Yeah, these are called junk bonds, and they borrowed about $1 trillion from individual investors. And for a while, things were going fine as long as speculation was high and as long as the Federal Reserve was printing a lot of money. But then the Federal Reserve, in October last year, announced that they were going to end QE. That's what they announced. Now, after they announced the end of QE, the banks don't have that much money to speculate, and oil started to crash, and now it's around $40
right.
a barrel. Come down from $100 a barrel. And so now you'll see all those people who bought these junk bonds, they are going to be in big trouble. and that's more than $1 trillion. So we are going to see another big problem coming out of this oil price.
Right. Can the U.S., will the U.S. really ever pay our debt, or will they default on it? Will our federal government default on the debt that they owe eventually?
No. I think after the reforms that I have suggested, after they are introduced, our debt would come down very quickly. It's a huge economy. The U.S. economy is a huge economy, and debt can be retired very quickly. We had a huge debt during the Second World War. The government borrowed billions of dollars to fight Hitler. And then within the next 34 years, almost the entire debt was retired. So the United States would not default on its debt. They would pay it because debt would come down once the reforms are introduced. And these reforms do not, I repeat, do not rely upon new laws. Laws already exist. Any president can utilize them, can use them, and create a free market in our system. And that will take care of all the economic problems.
Do you see ever a new Bretton Woods II ever taking place to readjust some of the currencies or anything like that or not?
Yes, that would happen. That would happen once the, people would not stand for the current, the system that we have in the world today. And so, let's see what happened in Greece. They changed the government. The government is powerless because of the power of other countries, but change will come. Change will come all over the world, and then you have all sorts of changes occurring in international economic relations and then also the power of monopoly capitalists would come down. So all sorts of reforms would occur. But I don't think they would occur before 2016 when the next election is due.
The Bank of International Settlements is Financial Stability Board is headed up by Mark Carney. Do you see that they're getting more and more into a regulatory type of system there versus just a clearinghouse for central banks? What are your thoughts? This is more financial than economic question, I know, but they're very important in the world, you know, and Mark Carney's been showing up at all these Bilderberg meetings, see, like, I was over in Copenhagen in 2014, and also at the G20 in Toronto, and it looked like around the G20 or the G7 or minus the Russia, they're going to organize some kind of a major Bretton Woods type of meeting. What do you think?
Even Mark Carney, the British.
He's also chairman of the Bank of England.
Right. Okay, yes. He's announcing that he's going to raise interest rates in the next meeting. I don't think it will happen because the world economy is in a very bad shape. The Federal Reserve might raise interest rates because they have been talking about it for the past 3 years. If you do that, just watch out. When they announced the end of QE, oil crashed. Now, if suppose they raise the interest rates, who knows what else would happen. So most likely with the stock markets around the world not in good shape, most likely the Federal Reserve will not raise interest rates in their September meeting. But if they do, then we have another big can of worms.
Now, what kind of advice could you give to the individual, the average person with $500 in their bank accounts or savings account? What kind of advice could you give them right now? First, go buy your book and start getting clued in, right? Huh?
Well, that they should know.
Yes, try to get knowledge of what's going on, right?
Exactly. Then they would know who to
look
for.
Right.
You know, knowledge is important. And then they should ask pointed questions from the politicians based on the ideas that I've offered. They can ask very knowledgeable questions from the politicians. Why don't you want to create competition in the economy. Why don't you want a free enterprise system? What do you get from this monopoly capitalism? Why don't you want to bring the interest rates down on credit cards to just 5% when these banks themselves were charging very low interest rates before the bailout started? That's the amazing part. After the Federal Reserve gave them money, their profit margin has doubled on these interest rate credit card loans. So you have to ask these kind of questions. Now, if suppose a poor person has $2,000 in loan. On that, he or she is paying 20% interest. They would never come out of their debt this way. So, and the Federal Reserve is giving free money to banks, and the banks have doubled their profit margin on these credit card loans. So the interest rate on these can be brought down to just 5% through the creation of competition, and I've explained how it can be done, explained in with the help of numerical examples, and some reviewers who really looked at these examples very carefully, they said yes, this can be done, and they asked people to call their congressmen, call their president, and show them how easy it is to bring these credit card loans interest rates down to just 5% instead of the current 20 to 30%, and that alone will create a tax cut for the poor and the middle class of $100 billion a year. Just imagine, poor and the middle class will have excess spending power of $100 billion a year when the banks have to reduce their credit card interest rates, and that is like a huge tax cut. And doesn't raise any deficit, doesn't create more debt. The poor and the middle class, their poverty disappears almost overnight.
Right. You know, this merchant's discounts are between 2 and 3% approximately. And when you look at how a person pays off their credit card thing fully each month, they make more money off the people paying in full each month than the others. Because it's a discount. It's a merchant's discount still charged in there.
Yeah, see, they have, first of all, if you're late by just one day in making a payment,
late charge, and then they're just charging up the gazoo on that. We're down to about 5 minutes left in the program. What other issues or topics would you like to speak on? I'm going to give you the floor for the last 5 minutes here. And you can just get into about any kind of a sort of a wrap-up here from Ravi Bhattari. We want to thank you for being with us this evening. We've really covered a lot, you know, more than just your book. But the world is just more than one book, isn't it? Huh?
That's
right. You've written quite a few.
And, you know, I have put my whole career on the line, and I wrote Greenspan's Fraud. Even my publisher at first thought that I had lost it. They would not accept the book as it was. They said we have to send it to a law firm to see what you're saying is right. And they sent the book to a law firm. The law firm kept it for 2 months, and then at the end they sent me an email saying that it is okay to have it.
Well, Ravi, you're a positive force in the world. Let's put it that way. People that stand up and you stand on truth. Is that right? That's what you're standing on. Huh?
No, that's right. Facts are facts. And they could not believe that these facts existed on paper. So I had to send them all sorts of material I had collected from various newspapers in which Greenspan had himself given interviews outlining his facts, outlining his views, and I sent these things to the law firm. They said, the knight of the world, the knight of England has done all these things. We don't believe it. They said, you go ahead. They told the publisher to go ahead and publish it with the title Greenspan's Fraud.
Oh, I tell you.
So it took a lot of guts at that time for me to write that book, but I want to inform the public.
How many books have you written now, Ravi?
I've written about 15 overall. And each one of them, I had to take a stand. For instance, I showed in Greenspan's Fraud that this man had promised the public to allow us, he said in 1983, allow us to raise your social security tax, almost double it, and we would guarantee your benefits for the rest of your life. And now, soon after he doubled the tax rate on self-employment and social security, he began to say, we have to cut social security benefits. And I said, if this is not fraud, what else is?
Right.
So,
man.
Yeah. And even now, he has been saying social security benefits are too high. Well, what has happened to all the taxes that people have paid? So they were, what happened was that they used these new tax revenue to pay tax cuts for the wealthy.
Right.
People like himself benefited from the hike in social security tax and the self-employment tax and so on. So I said, this is fraud. And then the law firm agreed that this was fraud and many other things he committed. His economic policy was also fraudulent, and I said it would bring about a mega recession all over the world, and it did. Then later on, Congress asked him to testify, and Greenspan finally admitted that he was wrong, but he then said, I don't know what mistake I made. You should have read my book to find out what.
Yeah, right. Read Robbie's book, okay?
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know, you've got to back it up with facts, and you do that. And that's what's good about you, Robbie.
Yeah.
You know, you just didn't, you know, fold under. You went back at him and said, hey, da-da-da-da-da, and this is it, right?
This is it, yeah.
And this is the facts, and this is the truth, and that's what you stand on.
Yeah.
What other? We've got a couple of minutes left. What other closing comments would you like to make? Oh, give me your website and stuff like that to our listening audience.
Yeah, it's ravibatra.com.
Okay.
RAVIBATRA, ravibatra.com. And it's a very simple website, and there are some old articles of mine on that, but many of the articles are like truthout.org and on Huffington Post, you can put them on your website. They're not on my website.
Yeah, we've got most of those click-offs already up on the site, too, so it's good to so a listening person could pick it up, and then they could also come into the secrettruth.com and also see your YouTube there. Interview by Manzoni and so forth. And, we want to just thank you, very much for, being with us this evening. We've covered a lot more than your book, and I really sort of had that in the back of my mind because you're a source of infinite knowledge and wisdom, and you say it like it is, and that's what I highly respect.
Yeah, I want to follow the truth. And that's what I want to do. And because I think in the end, the truth stands on its own legs.
Well, the legacy that you have will be a truthful one. Okay? Thank you very much, Robbie Batra. Appreciate you being with us this evening. So good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.